Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the third and final part in our three-part series exploring the many, many meanings of minhag within Jewish law, within halacha. And until now, over the past couple of weeks, we've explored minhagim that, to some degree or another, are unambiguously, unquestioningly legitimate, right? What exactly they are, what exactly motivates those different kinds of minhagim. Right, we've discussed various categories that those minhagim can fit into, that can make up those minhagim. Right, we saw last week examples such as halal on Rosh Chodesh. We saw examples such as the form of our tefillah, the form of our davening. We saw examples in the previous week of stringencies of chumrat, and we saw other examples too of other kinds of minhagim. But what I want to turn to this week are the kinds of minhagim that are fundamentally rooted in some sort of mistake. The first kind of minhag we'll spend some time discussing are minhagim that are in many ways the opposite side of the coin to the first type of minhag we discussed, which is minhagei chumrah. We talked about in the first shir, minhagim that are essentially adopted in order to protect a certain value, be that a halachic value or some other value. But the assumption until now has always been that those chumrat, those stringencies, made sense, right? If you instituted a chumrah, a stringency, to protect a certain halacha of Shabbat, for example, that's legitimate. But what if the entire notion behind your stringency makes no sense? What if you're actually prohibiting something that's just, it just doesn't even make sense to be creating the stringency to begin with? That's the first kind of minhag we will discuss. And the second type of minhag will be the ultimate example of the senseless minhag. Minhagim that actually contradict halacha, right? There are some examples, some more controversial than others, of minhagim which seem to actually fly in the face of what we are supposed to do. We are told to do X, and yet these minhagim come along and tell us to do Y. And that obviously creates a tremendous problem. So how to understand and process these two different types of minhagim, which, again, we use the term minhag for both of these kinds of minhagim we will discuss. And yet, obviously, it should be very clear, these are going to be very, very different than the categories we've discussed until now. With that, I want to first talk about minhagim that are fundamentally rooted in an error. And for that, I actually want to start once again, as I share the source sheet right now, with a source we saw in our first week, right? The classic example of the Minhag Chumrah, which was the Gemara in Masechet Psachim, which said the following source, number one. B'nei Baishan Nahug Delo Havu Azlan Mitzolet Sidon B'ma'alei Shabta. That on Erev Shabbat, on Fridays, the residents of Beit Shan wouldn't travel for fear that they'd kind of get caught, they'd get stuck, right? They wouldn't make it back in time. Whatever exactly is going on, their fear is that they're going to end up breaking Shabbat in the course of their business dealings, right? Atu b'nai kamei the Rabbi Yochanan. Their descendants came, right? So this has been a practice for a while. But then the residents of this town come to Rabbi Yochanan Amru Lo, and they say, Avahotin efshar lehu, right? This all made sense. This was fine for our ancestors. Their business was successful enough that they were able to observe this stringency on Fridays. They were good with that. Anan lo efshalan, but for us, right, this is tricky to skip out an entire day of traveling to the market. Right, that's just not possible. Amar lehu, he responds, Kvar kiblu avotechem aleihem, no dice, right? Your ancestors accepted this minhag, this practice upon you. Shne'emar shmabini musar avicha ve'al titosh torat emecha, hey, you're the musar of your father, but also the Torah of your mother, the minhagim, the customs. This was what we spoke about in the first week. And as I stressed then, it's a reference to minhagei chumrah, what we would later term minhagei chumrah. These are stringencies undertaken, again, to protect some sort of halachic value. The residents of the B'nai Baishan did not want to violate Shabbat, and so they created this stringency. However, right, what we did not look at that first time is the continuation of the Gemara. Right, the Gemara continues straight away with another case, and we'll see a third situation a little later. But for now, let's look at the next case. Still, now the second paragraph of source number one, right? B'nei Chozer. So in the first case, we saw an example where, right, people of a certain town did something. Their descendants tried to get it removed, right? No dice. Here, B'nei Chozer e nahage demafrushe chala me orza. The residents of the city of Chozai were, their custom was to be mafresh chala, to take chala, right? The obligation that when you've made dough of a certain size, right, you need to take chala from it. It's a whole, you know, halachic thing. There are other people on the Zoom who understand, who take chala. When, I don't, not something I really do, because I don't really bake chala, but they would take chala from rice. Not a thing. You don't need to take challah from rice dough. But they would make dough out of, they would make dough from rice, and they would take challah from it. Atu va'amru le'le Rav Yosef, and they came and told Rav Yosef about this custom. Amar lehu, he turned to them and said, Nechla zar ba'apaihu. Make sure you got to give this dough to a non-kohen and have him eat it in your presence. In other words, this is nonsense, right? You don't take challah from rice dough, right? You shouldn't be doing this, says Rav Yosef. You're doing the wrong thing. Stop it now in front of everyone. Make a big show of, right, abolishing this practice. However, the Gemara continues in a very interesting discussion, and it gives a little bit of pushback on Rav Yosef's insistence here. Itave Abaye. Abaye objects, right, with the following statement. Devarim hamutarim, regarding things that are permitted, va'acherim nahagu bahen isor, but others treat it as though it's prohibited, i ata rashai lahatiran bifnehem. You are not allowed to permit these actions in their presence. Says Abaye, what are you doing? Right, these people have just been, they've been machmeh, they've adopted this stringency to take rice dough, to take challah from rice dough, and you can't just kabosh it in front of their very eyes. Amar lo. So Rav Yosef responds, velav mi itmar ala, but what about the following? Amar Rav Chista bakuta e. Right, we are dealing with, that principle was dealing specifically with Samaritans. I don't want to get into what exactly Samaritans are doing in this story, but right, let's just ignore that bit. But Rav Yosef counters that whole argument, Abaye, irrelevant to me. However, the Gemara continues, Kuta'e my timer. Why did the Gemara say this? Why is this principle, why did Rav Chista insist on this when it came to Samaritans? Mishum dim sarche milta. Because they will extend this matter to other leniences. Hanach in Sheiname Sarche Milta. So too, the people of Chozai will extend this to other leniences. In other words, what's going on here? Right, there's a few different pieces to this Gemara. First is we see people are doing a minhag that makes no sense, that's rooted in halachic error, and Rav Yosef wants to abolish it. Ultimately, there is pushback, and the pushback is, right, if you now abolish it from these people, you're going to confuse them. Because what's going to happen is, right, you're going to tell these people, don't take challah from rice dough, and they are going to misunderstand it, and they are going to think what you're telling them is, don't ever take challah, right? Essentially, that's what the Gemara is worried about. And so it objects to any sense of course correction for problematic stringencies, because we're worried, right, the baby will go out with the bathwater at the same time. Nonetheless, we do see within this statement of the Gemara, within this case of the Gemara, the fact that, right, whereas in the previous example, the previous case of the B'nai Baishan, right, their stringency was very much binding. Here we see the implication that stringency is rooted in incorrect thinking, right, possibly are, right, overridden, possibly are no longer considered important. And what makes this such an important Gemara is because of the way it's understood by different Rishonim, right? The way the different commentators understand the rest of this Gemara becomes key for passing the relevance to our topic, which is, right, minhagim rooted in bad halachic decision-making, bad halachic thinking. Not all stringencies emerge from correct halachic decision-making, and so stringencies rooted in bad halachic thinking, right? How exactly do we understand, right, do we pass these sorts of ideas? So the Rosh Rabbeinu Asher source number two says the following when discussing this Gemara. Hilkach tzarich lom, and this is some crucial language for us. Hilkach tzarich lomar sheyesh chiluk b'minhagim d'matnitin ayri b'minhag chashuv. There is an important distinction to be made regarding minhagim, like above, which are minhagei chashuv. They are important, significant minhagim. Shenahagu b'nei hamakom al pi talmid chacham, v'talmid chacham nahag imahem. Right? Why are people observing minhagim? Right? So the Rosh says there's one category, the minhag chashuv, which are, right, a sage came and told you to do this, right? It's a stringency. And the sage came along, the rabbi got up and said, I think everyone should be observing this stringency. Says the Rosh, that's a real minhag. Aval minhag gerua, an erroneous minhag. Shel b'nei ha-medina shenahagu ma'atzmam davar echad. Right? Whereas if the people just decided amongst themselves, we're just going to do something now, right? Mutar lahatiran shelo bifnehem. Right? You don't need to cut, right? In front of them, don't not do it. But in general, right, don't worry about that minhag. That minhag is not binding upon you if it just came from, right, the populace as a whole. In other words, the Rosh draws, and we looked at the Rosh, I think it would have been in the first week, and this again follows on very much from his thinking, right, that minhagim, real minhagim, are instituted by, right, halachic decision makers who understand the halachic calculus. That's a minhag chashuv. A minhag garua is a minhag just instituted by the people as a whole. And, right, even though I don't really want to focus on this idea too much, I do think it's interesting that the Rosh essentially says that any organically developed minhag, right, is inherently minhag garua, right? If the community just developed on their own, we all wear blue shirts on Tuesdays. It's our minhag, right? Actually, that's a bad example because it's like it's not a real one. But like, I'm trying to think of now a good one without trying to think of actually a real example, which would be, you know, like if the whole community decided, right, we don't do the following thing on Shabbat, even though it's permitted, right? Says the Rosh, right? That's a minhag garua, right? That just emerged from everyone as a whole, and that's not, right, that's not really something we need to be concerned by, and ostensibly it's really, really easy to undo, or at the very least, it's something that you don't really need to be concerned about. If you move to a community and everyone is observing, right, if you turn up to BIEV and everyone observes a certain stringency because, you know, I got up and told everyone you need to start observing that stringency, that's very different to you turn up at BIEV and you learn everyone just observes the following practice because, right, you're not necessarily bound by that same principle to the same degree. And that's what the Rosh is getting at here with this fundamental distinction. For him, it's actually more about almost the originator of the minhag than the actual logic behind the minhag itself. The Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the other great Rishonim, however, suggests something slightly a different understanding here. Aval hacha askinan bidvarim hamutarim. But here, what we're dealing with in this case here are things that are inherently permitted. Va'acherim nahagu bahen isor. But others are treating it as though it's prohibited. The sovrim hain shehem asurim min hadin, but these people genuinely believe it's prohibited, right? These people, the people don't think it's just a gentle, right? They don't realize they're even observing a stringency. They think they're observing, right, genuine halacha. They think they are observing a true prohibition. By the way, this happens the whole time, right? The number of times all of us, including me, right, we hear things, we are told certain things about our Jewish lives, and we very, like, confidently repeat, you can't do this. And then it turns out, wait, who said that? Whoever said it's not something you can do. Right? That's fundamentally what the Ran is grabbing, is articulating here. Ubekahai gavna amrinan. In such a case, we say, she'ein adam rashai lahatir lifnei mi she'einan b'nei Torah. Here, says Loran, even though these people are doing something mistakenly, you can't just permit it. You can't just allow people to do these things if those people don't really, that they're not knowledgeable. The Misarchen, right? Because the fear is that same fear of the Gemara. What's going to happen? The rabbi is going to get up and he's going to say, "You, sorry, there's a fly like on my screen and I'm trying to murder it and failing. Alternatively, there's a whole host of flies buzzing around my screen. And every time I kill one, two more come in their stead. And everyone on the Zoom right now is just going to watch me be swallowed and taken away by the flies. And please help if that happens." But says the rant, right? If you see people doing a, right? If people are doing the wrong thing, right? You shouldn't actually correct them, right? You shouldn't actually tell them they can do it because, right? The chance of you doing that successfully and not all spiraling out of control, that's too much of a risk, right? If you tell people don't separate challah from rice dough, the risk is they'll just stop separating challah from all forms of dough because, right, miscommunication will always result. Aval, says the Ran, Talmid Chacham Hasharoi Betoch Otaha Ir, Noheg Heta Bit Sin Abatoch Beta. But a sage, right, or someone who knows what they're talking about, right, you don't need to be, right, such a person does not need to be so fearful, and they can do what they want privately in the privacy of their own home, where they don't need to observe such a stringency, right, if it's not actually something that's truly necessary. Right, so the Ran here, right, whereas the Rosh kind of has this like definition of minhagim, which is very, very broad, right? For the Ran, his consideration is slightly different, right? Fundamentally, even if people are doing the wrong thing, right, you should be very, very careful around correcting their errors because, right, the consequences might be a little bit, right? Things might spiral out of control. The Ramban, Nachmanides, and he has a very, very lengthy comment, and I've just pulled out two parts of what he says because I find them interesting. The Ramban has a very interesting perspective. Just first to draw your attention to the fact that this comes, right, the Ramban has many different works, and he has a couple of different commentaries on Gemara and Gemara-related things. This is from his commentary to the Rif called Milchamot Hashem. I always point this out, but the Ramban was a little bit of a, right, Rambam and Ramban, both were, by the way, but Ramban in this case, Nachmanides, and was somewhat of a little bit of a firebrand. And so he often wrote his commentaries because he was annoyed at other people's works. So, right, most of his Torah commentary, he's like, you know, he spends a good chunk of it attacking Ibn Ezra. Right here, he wrote the Milchamot Hashem to take issue with the Baal HaMa'or because he took issue with another commentary. And so he basically, you know, he wrote a the Milchamot Hashem, the wars of the law, of the wars of the Lord. Like he has a holy war against someone where he writes a work basically primarily to attack someone else's work, right? The Ramban was someone who, right, no holds barred when it came to what he thought was truth versus non-truth. But the Ramban says the following here in exploring the Gemara. Ubidvarim hamutarim. V'nahagubohem isa. When it comes to things that are permitted, but people act as though they are prohibited. V'halacha pesukasha minhagam b'ta'ut. And it's obvious, right? It's so clear that the halacha is that they're in the wrong, right? It's not like it's debatable, right? It's obvious they're wrong. Could go in challah de orza, such as taking, right, challah from rice dough. Ein notnin al haba chumrei makom shehalach l'sham. Right, so this goes back to the Mishnah we had seen in the first week again, and I referenced this earlier, right? When you arrive at a place, right, usually you have to accept all the chumrat, all the stringencies of the location you live in. No, not for things that are obviously beta'ut, things that are obviously mistaken. Va'af al pi she'ein da'ato lachzor v'hukva b'neihem. And even if you don't plan on going back, like you've moved to a new town, and they all observe this stringency rooted in error, you are not bound by that community's customs. Ella otzeh betzina betoch beta, rather just, you know, do your own thing, right, in the privacy of your own home. Ve'ino matirol lahem ve'lo nohig b'hem heta b'fneihem, but don't try and, you know, try and make them all stop doing it. Don't do it in front of them, but fundamentally, right, you are not bound by, until now, right, all of our question of minhagim assumes you are bound by minhagim, right? These kinds of minhagim you are not bound by, Regardless of other people, you yourself, you arrive in a town and they're adopting this nonsensical stringency, you are not bound by those stringencies. And the second idea that I think is very interesting, which really I think in many ways reframes our discussion until now, the Ramban in the second paragraph, V'yesh lefaresh bo afilu bekutib, and there are those who explain, even regarding the Samaritans, the following, Kevan shaba'im lishael, matirin lahem. If they are coming to ask and inquire whether something's right or not, right, then you can permit them to ignore the minhag. Ve'in lachush lesarcha. Right, and we're not worried about this whole confusion, everything spinning out of control. Shekvar hadavar merupabi adam. For everything's understood by them, right? It's all in their hands now, right? That they get it. Shehin boim li sha'el alav, they came to ask upon it. Umelamdim ad otan kol ikar hadvarim, right? And now that they understand, they've been taught all of the various details. Shelo yisarchu velo yistavku vohen. They're not going to make mistakes. Says the Ramban, a really interesting idea, right? Until now, the source is worried about things spinning out of control. But what if, right? Imagine this was a community, right? In BIEV, where we were doing some chumrah that didn't make any sense, right? And I decide to give, right, a PSA, shir. And we spend an hour, let's be honest, it'd be an hour and a half, because the introduction would take half an hour. We'd spend an hour and a half going through the topic, right? Understanding clearly why the minhag was incorrect. And everyone got handed afterwards out, right, a fact sheet to make sure they understand this only applies to the following thing. Right, all of the things still apply. And we wrote that 18 different times in bold, underline, all caps, right, to make sure there was no room for error. Right, says the Ramban, that's fine. Then you can abolish the minhag. Because, right, you're not worried about things spiraling out of control because things have been so clear and so obvious to people what the correct action now is. Practically speaking, we also see these ideas, you know, particularly of the Rosh, the Ran, these general broad ideas, and reflected in the codification of the Shulchan Aruch. So in source number 5, we read the following. And this is, again, right, part of a much larger, even though it's a pretty large paragraph already, part of a much larger statement of the Shulchan Aruch, but he says the following. Aval hanohagim isur b'dvarim hamutarim. Those who are accustomed to treat the permitted things as prohibited, machmat shesovrim shehem asurim, because they think it's prohibited, lo have ki'ilu kiblum beneda, we don't treat it as though they accepted upon themselves an oath. That has, you know, as we talked about in, I think, the first week, right, certain stringencies become pseudo-oaths, says the Shulchan Aruch, not when it comes to mistaken stringencies. V'yesh mi she'omer, and there are those who say, she'im to'eh, if one errs, v'nahag isur b'davar hamuta, and treats a permitted thing as though it's prohibited, nish'al u'matirim lo b'shlosha, right, they can be forgiven in front of 3, ke'ein hatarat nedarim, right, you can have a formal annulment of vows. V'im yodea shehu mutar, and if it is known that it is permitted, the nahag bo isor, but you acted as though it was prohibited, ein matirin lo afilu ke'ein hatarat nedarim. Right? No, you don't get to do annulment of vows. Dahavu ki'ilu kiblu al atzmo ki'isurim she'asartan Torah she'in laim hetelo olam, because it's as though you accepted upon yourselves the prohibitions of the Torah for which there is no reprieve. And the parenthetical comment is, v'ha minhag, it's funny that we get the minhag regarding minhagim. V'ha minhag k'svara harishona, the practice is to follow the first view. In other words, says the Shulchan Aruch, right? No, if you get yourself into a mistaken minhag, right, even if you kind of knew it was a mistake at the time, right, don't worry, right, you can absolve yourself of that minhag. So interestingly, the Shulchan Aruch provides a way out, a way of absolving oneself of chumrah. We actually had this a few, I don't think it was this past year, but it's been at some point in the past few years when we do Hatarat Nadarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah, right? We do an annulment of vows. And there was someone who got up in front of the Beit Din that was assembled And they explicitly asked to be absolved of a particular practice because, as they stressed, they thought it was the right thing to do, but now they've realized it was wrong. It was unnecessary stringency, and so they asked to be annulled of that practice, which was very interesting. I never actually seen someone do it before, and they just went and did it, which was very, very interesting. There is a fascinating comment also of the Shach. I forget what the Shach's actual name is. The Shach is one of the most important commentators. He doesn't commentate on all the volumes of the Shulchan Aruch, but he's one of the most important commentators. We've read the Shach before, and I always share the same fact, right? One of the things the Shach is famous for is correcting the record, right? Often, again, this is very familiar to, I think, everyone at this point. But often, right, halachic authorities, we forget, right, didn't have libraries, right? They didn't have printed books that they could just look up things and, they often did it from their notes or from memory. So sometimes they made mistakes. One of the things the Shach is famous for is correcting the record, right? Sometimes he will point out, oh, so-and-so quoted the Rashba. That's not what the Rashba says. The Rashba says something else instead. People were always perplexed. How did the Shach know this, right? One answer is he had Ruach HaKodesh, right? He had some sort of divine, spirit came and he was holy enough that he had it. The other answer is, well, we have his letters. To the person in charge of the library. He lived in a library town, and so he actually had access to a ton of these manuscripts. So he spent his days kind of researching all of these things and looking at the primary sources for himself. And that's how he actually knows often to correct the record, is because he actually, he did the hard work. He spent his days poring over all these manuscripts, trying to actually grapple with the various citations and quotations made by other halachic authorities. Here he does not do that, however, but he makes a really, really interesting point. Commenting on Machmat Shesovrim Shehim Asurim, right? On this whole idea that people believe something to be prohibited when it isn't. The Shach fills us in on a little bit more here. The Achshav Nitbare Shehum Mutar, and now it's obvious to them that what they were doing was actually completely permitted. Umin Hagan Haya B'taut Shenistafku Badavar. And their custom, they had kind of adopted in error, right? Because they'd kind of been uncertain about the whole thing, right? They just didn't know what was going on, and they decided to be stringent, and really they didn't need to be. The achshav shenitbarei shemutar, and now that they know it's permitted, it's clear that it's permitted. Lo havei ki'ilu kiblum b'neder. Therefore, it's obvious that it's not like a neder, it's not like an oath. V'nir'e dehu hadin im hayu sovrim shehu isur gadol. And this is also true, says the Shach, even if they believe it's like a major prohibition. V'achar kach nitbare she'in ba isur. And afterwards they learn, actually it's not prohibited at all. Kol kach lo havei neder. Even then it's not a neder. So the Shach introduces us to a possibility that he then rejects. Right? What if people thought, right? There are some situations, a lot of stringencies. People are self-aware that it's a stringency. They'll be like, oh, well, we know it's fine, but, right, there is the opinion of Rashi, and Rashi says this, so we want to be stringent just to cover all our bases. But what if someone genuinely thought it's prohibited on Shabbat? What if someone genuinely thought it's biblically prohibited to do X, right? It's a grave, grave prohibition. And now they've learned, actually, it's not an issue at all. They were completely wrong, right? Says the Shach, even in that situation, well, we might be tempted to say, given the severity that they assumed, was regarding the prohibition, no. Even in such a situation, right, we don't need to be worried about such things. The final thing I want to say on this, right, is kind of just a little bit to the general challenge of these kinds of minhagim. Right, because the other side of, as I said, the other side of the minhag chumra koyin, right? A minhag chumra is a genuine, legitimate stringency people undertake upon themselves to protect a certain value. These kinds of minhagim are just, right, the intent is there, but it's just wrong, right? It's based on sources that don't exist, or it's based on misreadings of sources, right? And this crops up the whole time. However, Chazal, and we saw within the Rishonim too, are concerned that there's going to be a little bit of the game of telephone going on, the game of whispers going on. That even when someone attempts to correct the record, right, miscommunications are going to abound and people are going to misunderstand what the correct halacha is. This happens to me Right, sometimes people will ask me a Shyla a question, and I'll turn around to them and I'll be like, "But just don't tell other people, right, what I said." Right? And sometimes it could be because it's a hyper-situational question, but other times it's because I know how this works, because I know how this works with other people and other rabbis. Right? Someone told me, a 20-minute scenario. I gave a, let's be honest, 15-minute answer, right? Which ultimately concludes, right, you're allowed to do it, right? What happens at the Shabbos table the following week? Someone tells a 1-minute version of their story, and they're like, and the rabbi told me yes. And before you know it, right, people not only now think something is permitted that isn't, but people, based on that story, derive, well, we heard that if this was a situation that the rabbi permitted, oh, our situation too is also permissible, right? It just becomes a nightmare. And the idea that I always think about when it comes to these sorts of challenges is an idea I've often spoken about. It's a recurring theme of Rabbi Sacks. I did not have the koach to find where he writes it most clearly in his book, but with a little bit of Googling, I was able to find one of his Divrei Torah, which somewhat grasps the same idea. Source number 7, where Rabbi Sacks writes as following: Torah study, once the specialty of the priesthood, became the right and obligation of everyone. Not everyone could wear the crown of priesthood, but everyone could wear the crown of Torah. A mamzer Talmid Chacham, a Torah scholar of illegitimate birth, say the sages, is greater than an Am Haaretz Kohen Gadol, an ignorant priest. Out of the devastating tragedy of the loss of the temple, the sages created a religious and social order that came closer to the ideal of the people as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation than had ever previously been realized. Said Rabbi Sacks, right, one of the fundamental ideas at the heart of Judaism is what he also terms in other places the democratization of Torah, right? Ultimately, right, we right, yeah, and even though the Rosh does admit, right, the Rosh's conception of Minhagim is rabbi-led, the reality is everyone has an obligation to learn Torah, right, almost to protect themselves against clerics, against, right, rabbis just telling them whatever they want to do. There's a famous XKCD, I've talked about it before. XKCD is a classic internet cartoon called The Wikipedian Protester, someone holding up a sign saying citation needed. If you've ever looked at Wikipedia, right, sometimes they flag comments someone makes on Wikipedia with no source to back it up saying citation needed, right? In Judaism, that is how we have to live our lives. You have to quote chapter and verse, right, to prove what you are saying is true. And this is, I think, such an important idea when it comes to that fine line between legitimate minhagei chumra versus minhagim rooted in a mistake, right? If we don't have the tools to evaluate it for ourselves, if we don't have the tools to be able to read the sources, then it can be hard for us to understand the difference between a serious minhag and a non-serious minhag. Just this week, and again, right, Kitniot is a classic example of a minhag chumrah. Just this week, I saw online again, right, people railing against Kitniot. And on the one hand, I get it. But on the other hand, right, almost both sides of the extremes of the Kitniot debate don't seem to be familiar with most of the Kitniot sources, right? They don't, but like a lot of people get caught in the cross fire of this whole debate, and then end up regurgitating stuff they saw someone else writing, right? But no one has that actual capability. No one seems to grasp the actual sources and articulate and express and understand them. And so, right, one of Rabbi Sacks's great calls to all of us was to take, right, this opportunity to learn Torah, right? Also, to kind of protect ourselves against what other people tell us. When they tell us you can't do X, right? Again, we sometimes have to accept someone's telling us we can't do X and they're probably right. But it is important for us to be able to go back to the sources, for us to be able to understand and realize and recognize why it is we can or can't do the various things that we do. So that is just a little bit on these minhagim rooted in a mistake and the possibility that that mistake. Right, that minhag isn't necessarily binding. What seems to bind the people to that minhag is not the correctness of it, but simply the fear of collateral halachic damage. I think that's actually an important point as I say it. Right, that's the real important point to stress here. Buried right at the end of me discussing it for the past half hour. Right, these kinds of minhagim do not bind people. and they're not even binding on the community that accepts them because they are real. We're simply afraid, right, of error. We're simply afraid people won't quite grasp all of the details. And so for that reason, right, they keep the minhagim unless someone can teach them otherwise. But there's no actual binding nature of these minhagim because they're inherently rooted in a mistake. The final kind of minhag I want to talk about are the ultimately senseless minhagim. These are the minhagim that are rooted in, right, aveira, right? They are ultimately rooted in, right, not just bad halachic decision-making, but wrong halachic decision-making, right? I told the story in the first week of someone who told me, they asked me a certain Shabbos shaila, and I told them, hold on a second, you can't be doing that anyway on Shabbat. And they were like, well, it's my minhag to do that on Shabbat. And it's just like, that's not a thing, right? You can't have a minhag to break Shabbat, right? These are the kinds of minhagim we are talking about. And some of the examples, we're going to look at a couple of controversial examples. And then we'll kind of the final one we'll talk about is, I would say, an uncontroversial one, but an interesting one nonetheless. However, this all starts once again from the Gemara and Pesachim. We saw in source number one, right, the B'nai Baishan, and then the B'nai Chozai, and now actually sparked by this whole conversation about taking challah from rice dough, we get a little bit more of the Gemara in Pesachim here, which says the following, source number 8. Ella Amar Rav Ashi. Chozenan iruban orez ochli. Here's how we actually process all of this. If the majority of people who live in the town, right, they primarily eat rice dough, right? The main bread they eat is rice flour based bread, la nechla zar ba'apai. We do not basically disband the minhag. Dilma mishtach cha torat chala minayhu, because otherwise we're afraid they'll just stop observing the mitzvah of chala completely, right? 99% of the time, they're baking rice dough into bread. So they're taking the chala from the rice dough, and we wanted them to do that so that they remember the law of taking chala. Ve'iruban dagan ochli. But if the majority of the bread that they eat comes from, you know, regular grains, nechala zar ba'apayhu, then we do, right, tell them to abandon the minhag. Dilma ate la'afroshe minhachiyov al ha'petor, u'min ha'petor al ha'chiyov, because now we're worried about something else, right? Imagine in a society where most people, like 99% of the time, they have regular bread made from wheat. But 1% of the time, they have bread made from rice dough. And they think, and they have a custom to take challah from this rice dough. Says Rav Ashi, we have a problem. They're going to end up making a big batch of rice dough, and they're going to make a batch of flour dough, you know, regular dough too. And they're going to take the challah from the rice dough, thinking that's acceptable. And they're not going to bother taking the challah from the regular dough because, oh, well, we took it from the rice dough. We dough is dough. Right, so says Rav Ashi, right, sometimes, right, we want people to stop a minhag because it is wrong. Because ultimately it is teaching them the wrong thing. It is teaching them something they should not be doing. And these are minhagim rooted in pure and utter error. And we are afraid that if people continue to observe these minhagim, right, they're just going to continue to do the wrong thing. On this, the Rosh says a very, very strident comment on these kinds of minhagim. Aval, im nahagu bimkomot minhag sheyesh bo aveira. Right, if people are doing a minhag that's actually an aveira, right, they have a minhag where they break Shabbat, yesh lishnot ha minhag, you stop that minhag, you change it. Afilu hanhigu gedolim et haminhag. Even if, right, great rabbis had been the original people who instituted the minhag. De'ein beit din matnin la'akor davar min ha'torah, because the beit din does not have the power to uproot the words of the Torah themselves. V'lomi baye minhag shel aveira sheyesh lishnoto. And this does not just refer to a true minhag where people are literally transgressing a prohibition in doing so. That needs to change. It's not just that. Ela afilu minhag sha'asu lesayag ulaharchaka Even a chumrah, and this is really what the Gemara is saying in source number 8, a stringency, which is actually going to lead to the opposite, and people are going to end up transgressing things. Yesh levatel at haminhag, here you must stop the minhag in its tracks. Things that are truly errors, you must stop them in their tracks. The Pri Chadash says the following in source number 10, just an interesting point. This is a debate. There are sources that disagree, but I just threw the Pri Chadash on here just to kind of introduce the idea. Even if the minhag is violating a rabbinic prohibition, it's obvious that you stop the minhag, the custom, right? There is that debate. Are we only talking about biblical transgressions or also rabbinic transgressions? Says the Pri Chadash, it's both. Any transgression is a transgression. And now we come to some controversial examples of minhagim that have been made in error. As I'm about to take a dramatic swig from my drink to give everyone what's he about to say. The classic example is the following in source number 11 from the Shulchan Aruch. Ma shenohagim la'asot kapara be'erev Yom Kippurim. Those people who do kaparot on Erev Yom Kippur, lishchot tarnagol al kol ben zachar, that they slaughter a rooster for every single male, v'lomar alav psukim, and they say upon it certain verses, yesh limnoa haminag, you must protest, you must stop such a custom. Right, the Shulchan Aruch did not like the practice of kaparot on Yom Kippur with chickens. We'll look at the second paragraph in a second, but first look at source number 12. Mishnah Berurah explains why. Yesham Noah HaMinhag, why do we stop the Minhag? Mishum Chashash Darchei HaEmori. Because we're worried it's a pagan practice, right? Slaughtering chickens, right? To absolve you of your sins on Erev Yom Kippur, says the Shulchan Aruch. That is, right, a pagan practice. Now, the Ramah, interestingly, in the second practice of source number 11, objects. V'yesh me'ha-ge'onim she'katvu min ha'gzeh. Hold on a second. The Ge'onim, some of the Ge'onim wrote down this practice. V'chein katvu oto rabbi min ha'acharonim, and many of the great rabbis also wrote this. V'chein no hagin b'chol medinat elu, such as our custom in all of our lands. V'in lishnot ki hu min ha'g vatikin. And therefore you should not stop it because it's an ancient custom, right? The Ramah raises the other, you know, aspect here, which is, right, if people have been doing it for many, 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 many centuries, and it's such a cherished Jewish custom, right, the fact that it's potentially pagan, potentially idolatrous, isn't necessarily a reason to stop it. Right, and this is very much a tension we see in a few different examples, right? So again, we have kaparot on Erev Yom Kippur as one example, right? Another interesting example is the very, very cryptic words of the Aruch HaShulchan when it comes to the practice of saying tashlich, right? Where he says, right, there are people who do not say tashlich for a reason known only to them, and that is the correct practice, right? Everyone always debates what exactly is it, right? There's a few different theological discomforts rabbis have historically had with Tashlich. One is potentially Darkei Ha'emori, one is potentially other issues, right? But Tashlich is another example where, right, it is a, right, and the question is, when does a minhag become so genuinely problematic that you must get up, bang on the shtender and tell people, stop doing it, it's horrific, versus, you know, it's just a personal practice not to do so, but, you know, but otherwise, who cares, right? This is sometimes awkward in certain communities where, you know, the rabbi doesn't say tashlich, but the rabbi's expected to know to tashlich, and it's transparently obvious he's not saying tashlich because he's not doing a good job at pretending to say tashlich, right? Right? As opposed to if you're just a regular member of the shul, you just don't go to tashlich, who cares? No one sees you there. But, right, but these, some of these are interesting, right? The other example, one of the most famous examples, it's coming up in a couple of weeks, shlissel challah, right? The practice of baking challah into a key, or putting a key within the challah, right? As a scholar around Pesach, many have argued, right? It's not originally a key, it's a cross. And it happens to be around the same time historically as Easter. And when the Christians were making, you know, crosses out of their bread, Jews were like, well, if we call it a key, then we can still, you know, we can be doing the same thing at the same time, right? Interestingly, I did just print off an article And this is unhelpful to everyone, especially people listening to the recording, but I'm looking to see if the art, if I can grab it with my hands, but I don't remember where I put it. Right? That was just in the newest journal, Hakira, the newest edition of Hakira, which is a phenomenal journal. Yankee Perlmutter's like cousin is the editor of it. But the latest edition of Hakira, right? Someone wrote an article basically being like, there are people who argue Shlissel Challah is an ancient Jewish custom that should be cherished, and there are those who argue Shlissel Challah is a pagan custom and should be stopped. Both are wrong. I didn't really read that. I just read that kind of like opening paragraph to see, but it's a long article. Not got a chance to read it yet. But right, that's another example of, right, something where, right, the issue might be, right, a genuine minhag that potentially leads to an aveira, right? If someone is going to be doing something truly pagan, something which smacks of avodah zarah, of idolatry, right? That is serious, right? And these sorts of minhagim require far more serious consideration than we usually give it. Again, we are often quick to try and dismiss kitniyot, one of the most serious of the minhagim, or 2 days Yom Tov. But when it comes to some of these other minhagim, where there's far more room to question them, we suddenly become very much more defensive about them, which is just a little bit of warped understandings of minhagim. The final example, which is a non-controversial one, is Rav Moshe Feinstein. But it's it, his language here, the strength of his language here is noteworthy, where he writes the following: the davar shebe'ezem mekomot, there is a certain practice in certain places. Nohagin shekorin at hatochacha, hatochacha, right? The curses in the Torah, sheba parashat b'chukotai uva parashat kitavo, below brachot. So there was this practice apparently in certain communities that, given these are curses, don't call up someone for an aliyah, right? The aliyah of the curses, just the lehna just reads, no one makes birkat haTorah. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, hu minhag ta'ut. This is an error. Va'asur lehitnoheg pain. And it's prohibited to do this. Ki asur lekrot ba'Torah b'tzibor af pasuk echad b'lo bracha. Because you can't read a single verse in the front of the community from a Torah, right, without birkat haTorah. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, when you come to these, right, error-based minhagim, no. Right, if you're blatantly violating, right, halacha, stop it right now. Turn the boat around, turn the car around, stop doing what you're doing, and abandon it straight away. And so ultimately what we've seen tonight, and more broadly over the past three parts of this series, is that the term minhag, as I said repeatedly in the first week, is a homonym. Right? We use the term minhag to talk about so many different things that we do in our Jewish lives. And yet, while the word minhag might be appropriate for all of them, as a literal is a custom, right? The seriousness, the sanctity, the importance of all of these different kinds of minhagim is wildly varied. In some cases, it's effectively binding halacha upon us, whether we like it or not. Whereas in other cases, we should literally be doing the opposite and stopping and ceasing all of these sorts of minhagim whatsoever. The final category, to which I obviously have no sources for, but the other way we use minhagim are just things we do, that tune you sing to Chad Gadya. And right, even though, again, the term minhag has a little bit of relevance, it's a custom, obviously. Right, it is a far cry from any of these sorts of categories that we've seen within halach. And so fundamentally, right, what I want everyone to kind of take away from this is that the next time you hear someone talking about a minhag, or you find yourself using the word minhag, stop and pause and ask yourself, which category is this going in? Which kind of minhag am I talking about? Am I criticizing a minhag that belongs in one of the most important and serious categories? Am I celebrating, lauding a minhag that really belongs in one of the meh categories? Or, right, have I got my minhag notions correct? Have I got my minhag categorization, right, in the appropriate bucket? And doing so, understanding these different, right, categories of minhag, hopefully sheds light on what is one of the most overused yet misunderstood terms we bandy about in our religious lives so often. And so hopefully over the course of this series, a little bit more clarity has been brought to bear on what exactly we are talking about when we invoke the term minhag to describe so many different things that we do.